From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson, along with Robin Young. It's Here and Now. It appears the Senate's backup plan to overhaul health care, a standalone repeal of the law known as Obamacare, is in trouble today. In the past few hours, a number of senators have come out against that idea. Last night, two Republican senators came out against a vote to move forward with a bill to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, dooming it. Here's President Trump in the Oval Office today.
And I think we're probably in that position where we'll just let Obamacare fail. We're not going to own it. I'm not going to own it. I can tell you the Republicans are not going to own it. We'll let Obamacare fail, and then the Democrats are going to come to us and they're going to say, how do we fix it? How do we fix it? Or how do we come up with a new plan?
Julie Rovner is chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Jeremy.
Well, let's start with the news that's just been breaking today, which is that now a number of Republican senators have come out against the latest idea from Mitch McConnell, which is repeal with no replacement plan and make it, you know, wait 2 years for the repeal to go into effect.
That's right. This was the bill that the Senate and House originally passed in 2015 as kind of a dress rehearsal if they ever got in power. It had trouble passing then. And to no one's surprise, there are already three senators who say they won't vote to even start debate if that's the bill. That's enough to kill this also. So now, you know, plans A, B and C have been shot down in the Senate.
Well, let's listen to what Vice President Mike Pence said in an event this morning.
The Senate should vote to repeal now and replace later, or return to the legislation carefully crafted in the House and Senate. But either way, inaction is not an option. Congress needs to step up. Congress needs to do their job. And Congress needs to do their job now.
So, Julie, what about that idea of picking up the House passed health care plan?
Well, they were actually always going to pick up the House-passed health care plan. That's how they're coming to the floor, because the Senate didn't have any committee action. So that's the only way they can actually start this debate, is by bringing up the House bill. But it was very clear very early on that there are not 50 votes for the House bill either. So that was never really one of the options. The Senate didn't like the House bill. Remember, they said they were going to start over. They didn't really, but what they offered up was quite different from the House bill, and that didn't fly. And what they offered up again was slightly different, and that didn't fly. And then going back to the old bill hasn't flown either.
Meanwhile, President Trump is out today saying we should just let Obamacare fail, and then the Democrats will have to come to the table.
The president has been saying this off and on for some months now. The problem with that is that every public opinion poll shows that the public knows that Republicans are in charge, and whatever happens to the health care system, they're going to hold the Republicans responsible, not the Democrats who passed this. So that won't really work, I don't think, for the president.
So what happens now?
Well, what happens now is the Senate is kind of, well, at this moment, they're having lunch trying to figure out what happens now. There is one possibility, and that's something that Mitch McConnell mentioned several times, which is that they could work with Democrats to patch some of the immediate problems with the Affordable Care Act, with people having to pay way too much out of pocket if they're buying their own insurance, with insurance companies dropping out. And there would be some fairly simple patches to do that, starting with paying the insurance companies money that they're promised under the law that the president has been threatening to withhold. So there are definitely ways to come at this and stabilize the market. Whether the Republicans want to do that and be seen as aiding and abetting Obamacare is still an open question.
Julie, in all the coverage you've done of the debate over health care, have you heard anything that they might turn to now that would actually bring costs down?
That's not really what this debate is about. This debate is more about who should pay rather than how much we as a society are paying for health care. There's a little bit, you see it in the prescription drug debate, doing something about prescription drug prices. There's a lot of bipartisan support for doing something about prescription drug prices, but it's kind of like repeal and replace. They say they want to do something about them, but there's no agreement about what exactly they should do.
So do you expect that Republicans and Democrats are going to actually get together and work on some of the fixes?
I don't know. One thing that I know that they have to do is the Children's Health Insurance Program, which is a bipartisan program with bipartisan support, is expiring. It needs to be renewed by the end of September. So that is a must-pass health bill. There's a possibility that there could be some kind of compromises to stabilize the market. It's not clear whether there will be enough Republicans who would join probably all of the Democrats in wanting to do that.
What are the key stakeholders, the insurance companies, the hospital associations and others saying about this? Or how do they feel today?
Well, you know, what's most surprising is that this bill was going forward and came pretty close to passing with the almost united opposition of the entire healthcare industry. They didn't do perhaps as much advertising as they did when the Affordable Care Act was passing, but they did a lot. They were very loud. They were all over Capitol Hill. Over the weekend, the insurance industry, which had been relatively quiet, also came out strongly, saying the last iteration of the Senate bill was unworkable in any form. So the idea that Republicans were ready to sort of buck the entire healthcare industry to keep their promise to repeal and replace was kind of surprising to a lot of people.
Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Julie, thanks as always.
Thank you.
As many as a million Americans are living with Parkinson's disease. Researchers haven't developed a cure, but they're making progress in helping people live with the complications of this chronic and progressive brain disease. And at the University of North Texas Health Science Center in Fort Worth, they're doing something unusual. They're making older people fall down. It's all part of a project to map how people with Parkinson's and other mobility issues react to jolts and falls. Stephanie Kuo from member station KERA reports.
Neva Fitz is 76 years old. She's standing on a giant treadmill, getting clipped into a full body harness. If she were to trip and fall, rope secured to the walls and ceiling would catch and dangle her several feet above the ground. It's all very Mission Impossible.
There's that certain amount of fear there, but you just think, okay, if I'm going to fall, I have to catch myself.
Fitz is also wearing head-to-toe black spandex with 54 gumball-sized bulbs taped all across her body, from the top of her head all the way down to her ankles.
And this is the same technology that they use in a lot of the movies these days. Avatar uses it. Back in the day, Shrek used it.
Listen, little donkey, take a look at me. What am I?
Really tall?
No! I'm an ogre!
You know, but here, it's being used at a medical school to study the human body. Dr. Evan Papa is a physical therapist and a principal investigator here at UNT's Human Movement Performance Lab.
Those markers allow us to recreate the individual in a three-dimensional picture on the computer. And then, in our laboratory, 12 cameras that go in a full 360-degree motion around the individual pick up those reflective balls, and they allow us to look at very minute detail.
Like the range of motion in joints, the knee, the wrist, the hip. What happens to each of them when someone falls?
That's one. Nine more, just like that.
Fitz begins walking on that giant treadmill. Things are going smoothly, and then she slips.
Quite a bit faster, right?
Yes. But we can induce what's like a slipping type of scenario, or we can induce a tripping type of scenario. And then we'll analyze how does someone with Parkinson's disease recover from a step, and how does that compare to someone who's neurologically healthy?
Parkinson's is just one of several conditions the Movement Lab studies. Researchers use the same gear to work with people with diabetes and autism. And they're using data from the lab to convince insurance companies to cover costs for better prosthetics and technology for amputees. Papa's expertise is Parkinson's, and today Neva Fitz is his neurologically healthy control. He'll compare her data to someone with Parkinson's, like Fitz's husband, Jim.
He denied it in the beginning, but it's generational. His grandfather had it. His dad had it.
Jim Fitz was diagnosed 6 years ago. Parkinson's is a progressive disease, so it's only going to get worse.
We can tell, you know, with the tremor, the jerking, but he has started to exercise. It's been beneficial for his balance because he trips easily.
A person with Parkinson's is up to twice as likely to fall as someone who's neurologically healthy, in part because people with Parkinson's tend to have shorter strides. Papa calls the cost for treating falls astronomical. The CDC reports 800,000 people a year go to the hospital after a fall, and the average hospital cost? More than $30,000.
So we want to prevent falls. We want to allow you to have the strength and the mobility to do the things that you want to do.
That's Dr. Rita Patterson, director of the Movement Lab.
Do you want to hold your grandchildren? Do you want to play golf? Do you want to walk and shop in the mall and have the stamina to do that?
Patterson knows what they do at the lab won't cure Parkinson's. There is no cure. But even small discoveries they make here go directly to doctors and physical therapists who can help improve lives with exercise recommendations, tips for caretakers, and new treatments. Patterson says analyzing human performance isn't new, and using motion capture isn't either. That's good news for Aneva and Jim Fitz.
Just said this is just one more bump in the road, so we'll, you know, do the best we can with it, and that's kind of how we've taken it.
Aneva Fitz says her husband's learning more about his body every day, and thanks to some ropes, a full body harness, and a bit of Hollywood technology, so is she. For Here and Now, I'm Stephanie Kuo.
A quick update now on a story we reported yesterday. A flash flood watch has been issued in the northern part of Arizona today and through tomorrow evening, including the watering hole where 9 family members were swept away and killed over the weekend by a flash flood. Authorities are still searching for a missing man, 27-year-old Hector Garnica. So an alert to our listeners in Arizona, there is a new flash flood watch. Meanwhile, to Minnesota, where leaders in the Minneapolis Somali community are worried about a backlash after the police officer said to be involved in the shooting death of an unarmed Australian woman was revealed by his lawyer to be Mohammed Noor, one of the few Somali Americans serving in the force in this state, which is home to the largest Somali population in the country. And the shooting in the Fulton neighborhood is at a time and in a place where police violence is already top of mind. Just over a year ago, Philando Castile was shot and killed as he sat in his car in a nearby suburb of St. Paul. A month ago, the shooter in that case, Officer Geronimo Yanez, was found not guilty of second-degree manslaughter. For more on the most recent shooting, Brant Williams, senior reporter at Minnesota Public Radio, joins us. And Brant, we're hearing that the woman, Justine Damon, that's actually her fiancé's last name that she took ahead of their marriage, that she made a 911 call to report hearing a possible sexual assault near her home, and that she was waiting outside in the alley in her pajamas when the police came?
That has been reported. What we understand is that, and we got this from her fiancé, Don Damon. He spoke to the media yesterday. He said that his fiancé had gone outside, and all he knows is that she wound up being shot by a police officer. Now, we know that by the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's report that she died about 20 minutes later from a gunshot wound to her abdomen. As you mentioned, she was going to be married in August. She'd used the name Damon as her professional name, but her family name is Ruschek. And as we've all heard, she is a native of Australia.
Well, let's listen to a little of her fiancé last night.
The death of Justine is a loss to everyone who knew her. She touched so many people.
This is so murky at this point. What more do we know about what happened?
You know, there's not much. What's going to happen is the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is going to, they're in the midst of their investigation. They are keeping details very close to the vest. There are certain details that might be helpful for us to know. How did she react when the police approached her? Did the officers yell anything at her? As in other police-involved shootings, there are commands made by police officers. Put down the gun or keep your hands where I can see them or something. We don't know if any of that was said. So we're going to have to wait until this investigation is complete before we get those crucial details.
We do know that the police did not turn on their body cameras. What's protocol?
Well, according to Minneapolis police policy, their officers are required to activate those cameras in more than a dozen situations. For instance, like when they conduct traffic stops or suspicious person stops, and they are also required to turn them on when they are in a use of force situation. Now, there's also a part of that policy that says that an officer, if they don't turn them on right away, that they should turn them on as soon as it is safe for them to turn on their body cameras.
Mm. Look, this is in the same Minneapolis-St. Paul area where we've been thinking very much of the death of Philando Castile because of the verdict that just came down in that shooting. He was black. That shooter was Hispanic. In this case, it's a Somali man, a Somali officer, a white Australian woman. What are people saying?
Well, we have heard there are a few community leaders here locally, Somali community leaders, who have said that they are concerned that this could lead to some type of reaction, people to use this as an excuse to react against Somalis. Now, I will point to you, there was an incident which happened in 2016. There was a shooting, a non-fatal shooting of five Somali men who were on their way to prayers one night. There was the man who was actually convicted of that shooting, a man named Anthony Sawina, was sentenced to 39 years in prison. I covered that trial. There were allegations, or there were charges that Sawina had used an anti-Muslim slur before he wound up shooting at the five Somali men. So that fear and those concerns are very prominent in the Twin Cities.
Right. Well, and again, just to confirm what we're hearing that the officer, Muhammad Noor, the Somali, has issued a statement of condolences.
Yeah, his lawyer, Thomas Plunkett, released a statement yesterday saying that Officer Noor extends his condolences to the family and says anyone else who's been touched by the event. The statement also says that he takes their loss seriously and keeps them in his daily thoughts and prayers. There's not an apology in this statement. That could come later. We don't know.
Brent Williams, covering Minneapolis for Minnesota Public Radio. Brent, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, our next story is a reminder to pay attention to what's stashed away in your attic. There just might be a priceless Civil War relic up there. Here now's Alex Ashlock has this report.
Come on, 54!
Colonel Robert Gold Shaw was the commanding officer of the Massachusetts 54, the first all-black regiment to fight for the Union at a crucial point in the Civil War. The story is told in the 1989 film Glory, Shaw, played by Matthew Broderick. He led a futile charge against Confederate troops at Fort Wagner in South Carolina.
By the time they get close to the fort, ground conditions have made it so that they're almost in a V, and he and the color guard are at the forefront, which is how they made it up the ramparts to the parapet first.
That's Ann Bentley, curator at the Massachusetts Historical Society, describing the battle on July 18th, 1863.
Right after saying Massachusetts 54th, forward, 54th forward, he drops.
Shaw was killed, but his men fought on. Ultimately, the Confederates held the fort. But the bravery displayed by the black soldiers that day would change the course of the war. Again, Ann Bentley.
This regiment served with distinction for the rest of the war.
When Shaw was killed, he was carrying a sword that had been specially made for him in England by the Henry Wilkinson Company.
That was the Rolls-Royce of swords at the time, and it was a very, very expensive and very valuable gift. And anyone who depended on a sword in war wanted a Wilkinson sword, so it was a generous gift from his uncle.
After Shaw's death, the sword was taken from his body by Confederate troops, who probably sold it to an officer. As the war was dragging to an end in early 1865, Bentley says Union General Charles Jackson Payne and his African-American soldiers were camped near Goldsboro, North Carolina.
Somebody came out of the house and asked if any of the black soldiers had been part of Shaw's regiment, because Shaw's sword was in a house in the neighborhood.
So General Payne sent some of his men to retrieve it. Eventually, the sword was returned to the Shaw family in Boston and given to his sister, Susanna. She passed it down through the generations.
It was given to my father years ago, I think when he was a child, by his great-grandmother, Susanna Shaw Minturn.
That's Mary Minturn Wood, who lives north of Boston.
My family never spoke about it. I never knew anything about it.
Until a few years ago, when they were cleaning out her parents' home before they sold it, when they found several swords, including one that stood out right away.
So we looked at it a little bit more closely and discovered that it was very nicely engraved with the American flag and other engravings. And on the other side, it had the initials RGS. And that's when we knew, uh-oh, this is a special sword.
But what to do with it?
This sword did not go into the tag sale.
This sparked a family debate.
Well, first of all, my daughter said it should be kept in the family. And I said, what part of the family? We're just a small section. It should actually be shared with the world. It should be on display. And the right thing to do is to donate it. So that's what we did.
And now it's on display at the Massachusetts Historical Society in Boston, where curator Ann Bentley showed it to me the other day.
Right there it says Henry Wilkinson, Pall Mall, London, the maker's mark. And you can see there's the American flag that's been etched into the blade. And then on the other side, very, very small. Can you see the RGS where my thumb is?
Yeah.
So it is rusty. It's been in an attic for a generation.
As she holds Shaw's sword, Bentley says it represents much more than a weapon of war.
For me, it's more the symbol that the sword is rather than the object itself, because it represents not just Robert Gould Shaw, but it represents the aspirations, the dreams, the hopes, and the sacrifices of all the men in the regiment.
Of the original 1,000 black men in the 54th, only around 600 returned to Boston in September of 1865. President Abraham Lincoln credited them and the other African Americans who fought for the Union with helping to win the Civil War. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
The California legislature voted last night to continue the state's signature cap-and-trade program through 2030. The bipartisan vote is a major victory for Democratic Governor Jerry Brown.
What's so good about this, and what we don't see in many other places, when you can lock something in with support of Republicans and Democrats, it has durability.
Joining us now is Guy Marzorati, politics reporter for Here and Now contributor KQED. He's in Sacramento. And Guy, the measure was approved by a two-thirds majority in the California Assembly and the Senate. How difficult was that for Jerry Brown to get such bipartisan support?
You know, it was difficult. Governor Jerry Brown really had to make deals to make this happen. And I think he was willing to negotiate with Republicans, with liberal Democrats, because he so badly wanted to keep this program going, keep California's role as a global leader in the fight against climate change. I mean, Democrats with the environmental justice movement were pushing for provisions to address local air pollution. They got a whole separate bill focusing on that. Republicans wanted a greater say in how the revenues from this cap and trade system are spent, and they will get that in the future. So, you know, even the deals and commitments were made down to the closing hours of yesterday's vote. It was all needed to get to that supermajority.
Well, and he did get 8 Republican votes to get this through. Let's listen here to the California Republican Assembly Leader Chad Mays, who supported the measure.
We didn't come here to Sacramento to just be Republicans and to hate on Democrats. That's not who we are. We came up here to Sacramento to try to make people's lives better.
So tell us exactly what this legislation, this cap and trade program, does.
So cap and trade is basically the market-based system that California uses to limit greenhouse gas emissions. So the state has set some pretty ambitious goals on cutting down on greenhouse gases. But instead of having the state just directly tell companies, this is how much you need to cut, cap and trade sets a limit on the overall greenhouse gas emissions and then lets companies buy credits in order to pollute, and then they can trade credits with other companies as long as they're all staying under that limit.
How are businesses in California feeling about it?
You know, surprisingly, businesses were largely in support of this measure. Most notably, the California Chamber of Commerce added on their support last week. That was a big victory for the governor. And that might have been something that helped a lot of Republicans come along, because I think in the mind of businesses, the alternative to cap and trade is being told directly by the state how much to cut emissions. So this is kind of the better alternative because they know they need to meet these state goals.
What are critics saying?
The critics largely came, I think, from the environmental justice movement on the left, liberal Democrats, who thought that the governor just gave too much away to industry in order to make this deal happen. There's a provision in the cap and trade extension that says local air boards can't regulate carbon emissions on top of what the state is already doing, kind of strips that local power. And that upset a lot of liberal Democrats who felt like, you know, this was a provision just put in place to get the support of businesses.
What does this mean for California's planned high-speed train between San Francisco and Los Angeles?
Well, a large portion of the money that's used to fund high-speed rail comes from cap-and-trade revenues. And recently, the revenues have been poor, largely because businesses weren't sure this system was going to continue into the future beyond 2020 when it was set to expire. So now they know that this system will go on at least till 2030, and we'll see next month at the auction in August whether businesses respond by buying up credits and therefore putting a lot more revenue into the state for things like high-speed rail.
That's Guy Marzorati, who is a politics reporter for KQED, joining us from Sacramento. Guy, thank you.
Thanks so much.
And now we consider the pun, the homophonic pun, words that sound the same but have different meanings. A walk in light rain is a missed opportunity, M-I-S-T. Homographic words, spelled the same but with different meanings. A blind man picked up a hammer and saw. Tonight, Punderdome, the Brooklyn Pun Fest, will host its annual New York Post edition. Writers from the tabloid that launched 1,000 puns off the Anthony Weiner sex scandal will face off with pun superstars. Our colleague Bruce Gellerman is legendary. When the Mir satellite crashed to Earth, he wrote the line, "Oy vey, it's Mir," taking off on the Yiddish phrase, brilliant. Journalist Joe Berkowitz writes about Brooklyn's Punderdome and the O. Henry pun-off in Austin, Texas in his new book. These are fierce, fun contests, and Joe even actually tried one. His journey is documented in his new book, Away With Words. Joe, welcome.
Hi.
So here's an example of the fierceness. You're in Austin, Texas, as the organizers are trying to pick categories for the competition. One is knives. Do you do things you can do with a knife, or is it just paring knife, butcher knife? Do we take razors? But if you take razors in the category, then you got to take Gillette. And the other guy says, and if you take Gillette, you got to take pen. I mean, these guys are serious.
They really are. That conversation went on for over 3 hours. And by the time it was over, I had the most enormous headache.
Because it devolves into punning competitions as they're trying to figure out what can be in a punning competition. There are puns. And then there's the Matt Lauer pun. What's the Matt Lauer pun? He, of course, the host of the Today Show.
Yeah, I think that is something like, you know, if the word railroad was the category and you'd say, well, I guess we'll stay on track.
When they said to you, I hope we stay on track as a Matt Lauer pun and it's not acceptable, you said.
I said, what about keep it rail? And that was fine.
They like that. Mm-hmm. All right. So who's in this world?
Well, I found out there were comedians and improv people, playwrights, ergonomic engineer, some computer programmers. So it runs a pretty wide gamut.
The topic is lions, tigers, bears, pet animals, all kinds of animals. Go!
I don't care who wins, but I hope that you all laugh at us a lot.
I had sort of been institutionalized that puns are not funny, everyone hates them, don't say them, or people will unfollow you on Twitter and, you know, roll their eyes at you in real life. So I just sort of kind of dismissed them altogether. But, you know, once I started going to these things, I very quickly saw how creative and clever they could be. And then I just noticed that there are puns everywhere. Novelty menu items and the banter on morning news shows, but then also on shows like Veep and Bob's Burgers and in every rap song and just...
Oh, yeah, you're listening to... Was it Kanye West?
He makes this noise that's like associated with cars. He's like, skirt, skirt, skirt.
Skirt, 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 like a private school for women.
Like a private school for women, I think that was the pun, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so skirts.
And so I heard that for the first time while I was driving to a humor research conference.
Let's talk about the humor research conference. Perhaps one of the most droll, at least the way, gatherings of academics. What did they tell you about why people pun?
Well, everyone seemed to agree that it was some kind of a disorder in the brain. And I still don't think so. I think it's a talent. And I think there are people, there's a disease called Witzelsucht. It's a disease where if you have a stroke maybe, and all of a sudden you are constantly making puns to the point where there's definitely something wrong with you, that's different than just your friend at the office who tends to pun too much.
Well, and by the way, this was the Northeast Texas Humor Research Conference, you know, lightly attended.
Yeah, they say, you know, that if you listen to the meaning of words, that's where the humor should be, not in the way the word sounds. Anyone who focuses too much on the way the word sounds, they're immature. But, I mean, the immaturity part, maybe, because, I mean, you know, but I don't think there was something wrong with their brains. I disagree with that diagnosis.
Well, here's one of the puns. This was on a podcast. This is how people practice, by the way. They practice for these competitions. And one of the punsters, Jersey, 99 ducks walk into a bar. The bartender says, "We don't serve ducks here." And the ducks say, "Oh, but you're down with geese?" Get
it? Yeah. It's not the world's most amazing joke, but it came up immediately. He was given the category, you know, with that joke format. That's what they do, a 99 blanks walk in a bar kind of thing. And so someone said, was it birds or ducks? And yeah, you came up with that down with geese thing right away.
Well, you were trying to practice with a category of feminism. And didn't go well in some cases, but suffragette, you came up with, "I can take a plane, but I will not suffer a jet."
Mm-hmm. And then moments later, I realized I could have made it mansplain, but it was too late.
Who are some of these people?
Oh, the punters?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, there's like Jerzy Gwozdowski. He's probably the best in the world right now.
"I just walked through all 50 countries in Asia to be here. Actually, Iran. Listen, it didn't work out between me and Marge. She knows I'm still India, but she wants something permanent and serious. But every time I look..."
Jersey, he's a playwright and an actor. He's been on Broadway. He's been on shows like Girls and, you know, Law and Order and things like that. And now he teaches at New School. And then his rival, Ben Zeke, is this guy who was a game show phenomenon. In that he's been on 6 or 7 of them, I think, and he's won, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, and he has his own company where he brings the game show experience to you.
"I was at home in my two-room apartment eating some cold macarena and cheese, and I said, 'Look in the mirror and tell me what to see.' I would be going on a limbo if I said I didn't get depressed. So I went up to this Swingles bar."
Yeah.
And they become rock stars.
Yeah, I was surprised that I saw punsters getting hit on at the very first time I was at a Punderdome.
I'm going to find that line. Somebody wrote a note to somebody.
Oh, you make me corny, which itself is corny. So there's kind of a meta thing going on there, too.
Well, we also learn about the history here. John Pollock, by the way, you recommend. He has the definitive book on puns, The Pun Also Rises. Chamulan men near San Juan have verbal duels called kahel kaap, involving puns. Palestinian weddings often have pun-filled poetry duels. What are you finding out about yourself and about punning as you're trying to do it?
I can be kind of an awkward mess on stage. So just having to have all this experience of trusting my gut and coming up with stuff off the top of my head, it was pretty cool. It was kind of transformative. One time the category was TV shows. And so I start off by saying, like, "Why are we all here?" Like the show The Wire. And then I realized I had to answer that question. I was like, "We're here for growing puns." And they didn't like that second part. They were with me on the first part, but then the answer they did not like.
Well, at one point, you score a coveted 10 on the clapometer.
The 10, that was, the category was amusement parks. And I don't know, I was just in the zone. So I came up with this story about proposing to my wife. So something like, you know, I was a little nervous, so I went into a safety bar, and then I ordered a ton of olives, but I said it in a way that sounded like tunnel of love. I mean, they don't have to be great, but if they're on a theme, the audience just goes with it. And I was like, so then I got down on Disney and did a ring toss.
And you got down and said, it's you and I.
It's you and I versus all.
What's
like
that?
Universal. Like Universal Studios.
Oh, but you met people who talked about having to sleep with a radio at night so they wouldn't be thinking of puns. These people look tortured by this.
Yeah. When I first started working on the book, everybody I met in Brooklyn, they surprised me with how mostly normal and pretty cool they were. But then when I went down to Austin, then I met people like the guy who couldn't sleep unless he was blocking out the puns coming into his head and things like that. And I was like, OK, they're here.
Look, we want to run one by you. It's the son of our producer, Karen Noah. They were on a safari and somebody said a branch was a leopard's dangling arm, but it wasn't, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so Noah said, "Well, that was a faux paw."
Yep. That works.
That does?
That's a pun.
Okay.
It's a pun, yeah.
Ouch.
Give it a 7 out of 10.
Joe Berkowitz, author of Away with Words, An Irreverent Tour Through the World of Pun Competition. He's also a staff writer at Fast Company. Joe, thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
Elon Musk is urging U.S. officials to regulate the future development and use of artificial intelligence. The SpaceX and Tesla CEO spoke at the National Governors Association meeting over the weekend, stressing to leaders what he believes is a major danger to human beings.
AI is a fundamental risk to the existence of human civilization in a way that car accidents, airplane crashes, faulty drugs, or bad food were not.
Joining us for more on this is our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Tony Rahm is senior editor of policy and politics for Recode. He joins us now. Hi, Tony.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, and this is not the first time that Elon Musk has talked about the dangers of artificial intelligence, but it certainly did catch the ear of governors. What did he tell them about why he's worried?
Yeah, Elon Musk is no major fan of artificial intelligence. For a long time now, the founder of SpaceX and Tesla has warned about dire consequences of AI, whether it's millions of Americans potentially out of work or robot overlords that, start to patrol the streets or something pretty consequential like that. And so while he was sitting with a bunch of governors from both parties at a meeting in Rhode Island this weekend, he encouraged them to regulate. He asked governors to take a closer look at this field and to begin to think about consumer protections that could deal with some of the economic and security issues posed by AI.
And how far into the future are the problems that Musk was talking about?
You know, in Musk's mind, they're very soon. And I think there are a lot of studies that suggest that we could see some effects of AI play out in the U.S. economy sooner than later. You know, there's a report out by PwC that found approximately 40% of U.S. jobs are at risk of disruption by artificial intelligence by about the year 2040. You know, that seems far away, but it's also not very far away. And you have plenty of companies like Google and IBM and Microsoft that are spending millions of dollars every year to start to think about ways to automate tasks and use powerful algorithms to do everything from, you know, improve the way factories operate to, and like, you know, help cars drive themselves and drones deliver packages.
It's interesting, though, that Musk feels that way, because I remember back in March, the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, talked about AI with Axios founder Mike Allen and said this.
In terms of artificial intelligence taking over American jobs, I think we're like so far away from that Not even on my radar screen.
How far away?
Far enough that it's
seven more years.
Seven more years. I think it's 50 or 100 more years.
50 or 100 more years. So, I guess safe to say that Washington is not really thinking about this problem right now.
Well, remember, Mnuchin took a lot of criticism for saying
right.
that. There were a lot of folks who spend money on artificial intelligence, who do this research, and labor experts who all said that the things that he was describing were going to happen way sooner than 50 to 100 years. And there's definite concern that as artificial intelligence begins to result in innovations that replace humans in jobs, that there's a need to retrain these workers. But I think Mnuchin's comments illustrate that there's a bit of a knowledge gap in Washington, D.C. on how this technology works and what exactly to do about it.
What about in Silicon Valley? Do other leaders in Silicon Valley share Musk's view?
Oh, it's full steam ahead in Silicon Valley when it comes to artificial intelligence. You know, in a sense, Musk is sort of a canary in a coal mine. He's even criticized Google, where he's put some of his money into the technology, you know, that Google is producing around artificial intelligence, raising concerns that companies like Google could produce some of the most evil innovations around artificial intelligence. So it's a bit different to hear a leader from Silicon Valley ask for regulation of the industry of which he's a major player.
So if part of the solution is awareness, here, how do you convey to everyday people how serious of an issue it is? Because when you talk about the problems with AI, it does start to sound like a sci-fi movie.
It sounds like a sci-fi movie, and it's a very difficult one to understand. I think artificial intelligence means so many different things to so many people, and it encompasses a broad array of technology, from the things that Facebook puts in place to help spot you in photos and recommend tags, all the way to self-driving cars and self-flying drones that deliver packages. So there's a lot of education that has to be done, both among policymakers and Americans, to truly understand this emerging field.
There's another part of the story, which is that AI research and development has turned into an international race of sorts, China spending billions to match or outpace the U.S. Are people worried about that?
Yeah, there are definitely folks in Washington, D.C. who always ask these questions about whether regulation in the United States keeps the U.S. second or third on those list of countries that are investing heavily in areas like AI. And this has really come up around the issue of self-driving cars and self-flying drones, where there are a lot more regulations of U.S. roads and U.S. airways than there are in foreign countries, which is why so many tech companies have flocked overseas to begin testing their technology. But I think at the end of the day, there are a lot of issues that the U.S. government has to address, whether it's safety and security or, you know, just basic logistical issues around the operation of AI that people like Musk are beginning to say, you know, hey, it's time to wake up and start to debate these things in D.C.
Are you worried about AI?
I'm worried about a lot of things.
That's Tony Rahm, senior editor of Policy and Politics for Recode. Tony, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.